My fellow listeners, thank you for listening. I'm happy to announce that...
You're not fooling anyone.
I hereby announce a grand new project in the history of podcasting as the proud ruler of Tweedonia.
Population one, ruler one.
Stop it, Carolyn. I'm addressing an international audience. I hereby announce...
Maybe you should just shill for Coca-Cola.
Pay no attention to the pink-haired delegate from Pittsburgh, a place that is hardly a kingdom. Tweedonia has had a long history of hunger, suffering, and bad television, as the queues around my palace have demonstrated.
Yeah, setting up your throne near a homeless shelter was a swell idea.
Will you just let me make my announcement? As ruler of Tweedonia, I hereby announce the beginning...
Tired of reading the same old books? Why not check out the Litblog Co-op? Sure. You probably know about it already because you're listening to this podcast. But why not experience it again? Catch the page.
And with that in mind, thank you for your attention.
You're welcome, Sun-Kissed King. Coming up, a real Regal Beagle.
Hi, this is Pinky, and I'm here with Carrie from Tingle Alley, who has nominated Wizard of the Crow for the LBC.
Hi, Pinky.
Hi, Carrie. So, when we first talked, we agreed that I would be the one who would try to pronounce the author's name.
Oh, are you going to go back on that?
No, I'm going to try.
Okay, go for it.
So, Wizard of the Crow is by Ngugi Wa Thiong'o, or mm-hmm. something like that, who's a Kenyan author. So, tell me, first, how did you find this book? How did it come into your sphere?
Well, I read about it in the New Yorker. John Updike had a long review of it, and I thought it sounded fascinating, so I tracked it down and read it and loved it.
So give me a thumbnail sketch of what this book is about.
Well, that's difficult because it's such a big book.
Okay, give me a big thumbnail sketch.
Huge Paul Bunyan thumbnail. There's this, it's about the Free Republic, and I, again with the pronunciation, Iberia, I will say, mm-hmm. and which has a dictator. And it is about a period in that country where the dictator has decided that they're going to build this tower that reaches to heaven, and then there's all these adventures of various characters from different walks of life working for and against that. And one of them is a young man who's very well educated, who through a series of accidents and misapprehensions becomes known as the Wizard of the Crow, a very powerful sorcerer.
So would you say the book is it funny? Is it serious? Is it both of those things?
I would say very much both of those things. I think it's funny in a couple different kinds of ways. It's funny in a pointed satirical way when it's talking about the government, the things about how the government works and how the politics of this country work in regard to... For example, there's this thing where this demonstration, this political uprising has happened, and the leaders of the World Bank are there to see if they're going to fund a project, and these women have very bravely staged a protest of the ruler, and so they tell the global bank representatives who are, you know, from prosperous Western nations, that the protest of these women was actually a sacred dance of the country. And that way, it's very, you know, a little, not quite bitter, but pointed. I think there's other ways it's funny, that it's just about human nature and how humans are funny. There's, when the Wizard of the Crow is set up, there's a funny bit where a priest is seen by one of his parishioners sneaking away from the Wizard of the Crows, because he's obviously, you know, as a priest, shouldn't be there. And that to me is beyond politics. It's just how, it's just very funny.
And is this fictional nation, it's sort of, it's Eastern Africa-ish?
I think so. I'm not really knowledgeable enough. I know Thiong'o has been really involved with Kenyan politics, and so I assume a lot of things about that, that some things are pointed towards politics and from things he writes in the acknowledgments, but I really don't know.
So as we're talking, we know that the LBC has selected this book as its Read This pick. Can you tell me what are the aspects that you think set it apart from the other books this time around?
Well, what I nominated it for and why I was glad so many people that I guess write that a lot, it would be appealing to a lot of people, is on the one hand you have this story that's just a really great story. There's just these ridiculous things happen. They're very funny. It's just the kind of thing that you read and you can stay up because the adventure is good. I think on another level, it works as satire, and so it's enjoyable to read it and that. And then finally, I think on a technical level, which you can decide to pay attention to or you can decide that you're not going to pay attention to, but if you do, Thiong'o is doing these really amazing things as a writer. It's a very complex structure. And so I think in that way you really have to admire the artistry of what he's done. And so I think, you know, I'm not sure what each person voted for or if it was a combination of all of that, but I was hoping that at least one of those things, if not all of them, would catch different people and make them like the book.
Before we cut over to our interview with Thiong'o,
which I'm looking forward to.
Me too. Is there anything else that you'd like to tell us about the book before we go right into his interview?
Well, the only thing I would say is it's a big book and it can be imposing. Some people like big books and take it as a challenge. I think other times people mean to open it up. I would say to try it, give it, the first 40 pages are disorienting, but keep on and then it'll go into this great story. And the 40 pages are disorienting, not in a bad way, but just in the sense that you're meeting lots of people and you're not quite sure where it's headed. And so I think if people give it a chance, they'll love it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So I'm here with Gugiwa Choino, author of Wizard of the Crow, which is the LBC nominee for this quarter. Gugi, how are you doing?
Very fine.
That's great. That's great. Now, I wanted to first of all ask you, one of this book's really fantastic achievements is the way that you sustain this extraordinary premise of the entire nation of Abruria believing in the authority of the Wizard of the Crow. And I suppose you allow your readers to believe in this because the others' characters believe in this. I was wondering, what steps did you take as an author to kind of just ensure that this plausibility existed?
Oh, yes, really. Yeah, that's one of the challenges, of course, of every writer, particularly if you are, you know, dealing with a fantasy. You have to find ways of making the reader believe in the premise. It's the old saying, I think articulated by, I think Wordsworth, about the willing suspension of disbelief, you know, as a challenge to every writer. In my case, you know, it's like you get the logic of what is realistically possible and you extend that logic to its various possibilities. Yeah.
One of the things also about this book that I found quite interesting is the way that you have supporting characters or events that are introduced, and we don't quite know why they interconnect, but then what happens is that you have this interesting tendency to follow up, and then we get this sort of explanation. I was wondering if this kind of narrative explanation sort of ties into
what you're talking about here, quoting Wordsworth with the suspension of belief.
Yeah. By the way, one of the things, I don't know if it's connected with your question, but one of the things which was, you know, one of the, well, call it tactics I used, is first of all, getting a character mentioning, or even a narrator mentioning something in passing, which may look very almost, if a reader is not careful, he might actually miss it.
Mm-hmm.
But then as you go on, that small thing mentioned at the beginning becomes larger and larger and more significant. Mm-hmm. For instance, the issue of hewing.
Yeah.
The way it begins is almost offhand.
Yeah.
And then as it goes on, it increasingly becomes more and more important, more and more central, connecting the various events, yeah.
Gotcha. You, this is actually your longest and most ambitious work, and I've read in other interviews that you wanted to sum up Africa in the 20th century and the context of it in the last 2,000 years of history. Now that the book has been released to the world and is now having an American audience as an English audience, do you regret not including any specific historical moments in this book, or...?
Not really. You know, that intention largely remains true and relevant to the reading and interpretation, you know, of the novel. Although I might put it slightly differently. That's why I call it, you know, a global epic from, you know, Africa, an epic that speaks to our times, but using Africa as the basis of that. Because I'm looking at the interplay of global forces, you know, both contemporary and historical, you know, on our lives, but with Africa as the center.
Mm-hmm. Now, you take on a lot of targets in this. You have you take on imperial hubris, domestic violence, international relations, racism, this concept of white ache, AIDS, the influence of the church. Did you ever feel, while you were writing this, that you were biting off more than you could chew? Because you do tackle quite a lot of issues in this.
Yeah, what actually happened, and I've been saying, as you know, the novel was, I started writing the novel, I believe, in May 1997.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not until the year 2002 did I feel that I had now, you know, finished the novel. Now, for those 10 years or so, you know, the novel virtually possessed me.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a way in which the story carried me along, you know, although as an artist, I did try to control it, you know, as well. So the key thing is how the story manages to put all those issues together so that there is a coherence, as it were. As I said, I was trying to look at the global forces that are shaping our lives. And definitely, all those forces are shaping our lives, and more important, they are all interconnected. You know, disease, for instance, you know, needs to become global anyway. You know, for instance, you know, and what happens in any part of the world, you know, will affect what happens in other parts, you know, of the world. Imperial wealth is definitely connected with the impoverishment, you know, of the third world, you know, for instance, you know, domestic violence in Africa, in Europe, and America is connected also with the larger, you know, social forces, you know, in the same societies, you know. So, as I said, I was looking at all the forces that are making or shaping our lives today, and all those social forces are definitely making an impact all our lives, whatever we live in the world today.
Gotcha. I wanted to talk also about these particular forces, all these many forces, because to some degree it's real, to some degree it's absurd. Perhaps the greatest absurdity is the ruler's great project, Marching to Heaven, which is this Babel Tower-like sort of endeavor, which is about the most ridiculous thing to expect this the Global Bank, which is kind of like a substitute for the World Bank, to finance. But yet, the sheer amount of negotiations here are very much, you know, real and bureaucratic and quite sort of astonishing. I was wondering if you could comment upon the relationship between sort of absurdity and grounding the book in this kind of realism.
You know, first of all, what happens in ordinary life is both magical and also absurd. Mm-hmm. For instance, is there any greater absurdity than the fact that in any part of the world in which we live, we make billionaires and billionaires and billionaires out of the poverty mm-hmm. of very many people? To me, it is not, it's actually absurd.
Yeah.
Because that accumulation of wealth amidst poverty or the majority doesn't really make, you know, much sense. And yet, the relentless pursuit of wealth at the expense of many people is what is driving the world today. Is there any more absurd than the fact that today we advocate the democracy and the freedom of capital move across various borders and across many states, and yet at the same time erect barriers to the movement of labor and peoples and so on? And yet this is what is driving again the world today. Is what is driving, you know, democracies and so on. Democracy meaning literally the movement, the freedom for capital to move across, you know, various borders without any restrictions.
So for you, it seems that the absurdity of this concentration of wealth on the backs of people who are impoverished, this in itself is absurd enough to sort of propel further absurdity on your part within the course of your fiction?
It's absurd because, I mean, for instance, okay, put it this way, the whole notion, if you look at what drives the world over the last 500 years, and that's why I call it about Africa in the context of so many years of history, the logic of what drives the world over the last 500 or 600 years or so is the logic that I can only be clean by pouring my dirt on other people, that I can be free of leprosy only by passing on that leprosy
yeah.
to another person. The notion that we too need to be clean to keep up our cleanliness does not seem to be driving the world. It's the other way around. You know, that I am healthy only if and when I'm able to make another person carry my diseases and illnesses.
Yeah, yeah. So for you then, it's really this matter of, I guess, is fiction, or specifically The Wizard of the Crow, a way for you to kind of recontextualize this notion of getting strength off of disease, that kind of thing?
Yes, in a way, you know, that's true. But also, in the world in which we live, right now in the third world, particularly in the era of dictatorships and so on, fat is often stranger than fiction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the challenge that writers have, that writers who come from those kind of societies, how do you create fiction, if you like, you know, in a world where actually is stranger than fiction.
Yeah.
And I'm not surprised that that writers and artists are reverting more and more to the folkloric, you know, for their inspiration, given the challenges of that situation where fact is all stranger than fiction.
Is the fact that fact is stranger than fiction, is this what kind of propels you or gets you into this more sort of comic mindset?
Yeah, absolutely. Because if you look at the folkloric element in many cultures, peasant-based cultures, you know, there's no restriction. There's no restrictions in terms of movement in time and space. You know, there's no absolute barrier between various species, meaning that in the folkloric, animals talk to humans. People can change forms; they can become plants, or the other way around. You know, so there is constant changes in nature. You know, and a lot of metamorphoses. You know. In the world, very much, if you like, you know, I see the world assumes the themes of it, metamorphosis, you know. This is important because in a way it enables, it releases the imagination. When the imagination does not have to be restricted within the boundaries of what is logically possible in the immediate, you know, natural world, or in terms of the way we experience, you know, reality.
So imagination is...
But in another sense, it's a deeper reality, because when you say that animals and plants and humans, you know, are constantly, you know, talking to each other, or they are connected, all one is saying is that behind apparent diversity of creation, there is unity. There's unity in the universe. And if you look at what we share, all of us, the air, water, everything we share, you know, so in that sense, you know, we belong to the same universe. There is unity, but that unity manifests itself in diversity.
So I guess what you're suggesting here, or what I'm actually hearing from you, is that imagination in its own sense, for both reader and writer, is in a weird way a kind of liberating force for us to kind of dwell upon these very absurdities within truth.
Yeah, the folklore allows the imagination, I think, free the imagination a bit more than the, say, the realism that we see in the 19th century English novel, you know, for instance. Another thing, just to go back to the question of sanity, the way, if you look at dictatorships anywhere in the world, particularly the post-colonial dictatorship, I look at tragedy as dictatorship as tragedy, but it's a tragedy which manifests itself in comedy, okay? And, for instance, a good example of this is how the post-colonial dictator, of course, rules by fear, terror, you know, genocide, massacres of peoples, and so on. But there's a way in which the same dictator is actually ruled by fear, you know, and terror. You know. So when you look at some of the characters in Wizard of the Crow, the psychophants, and so on, they themselves live in terror in their service to, in my case, or in the case of Wizard of the Crow, in their service to the ruler.
That's true, and the whole thing is contingent upon a series of misunderstandings, not just from the title character, but also from the ruler.
Yes, you know, because you know the ruler, in his absolute conviction that he knows everything, he may find that he knows often very little.
Yeah.
Rather, to be another way, his even small things that are completely innocuous may assume a bigger threat in his imagination, because by assuming that he knows everything, he finds that actually he is almost in the dark about everything.
Mm-hmm. I actually wanted to ask you about, aside from these experiential musings on your part, I was wondering if there were any specific sort of comic literary inspirations for you. I read this book, and it was almost like reading the great Marx Brothers movie Duck Soup at times. And I also wanted to ask you, were there any perhaps specific African literary comic novels that you might have been thinking about? Or what were some of the great sorts of works that went inside your mind and offered this kind of melting pot of absurdity and satire?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, in the history of literature, of course, there has been a lot of this kind of thing, I believe. So, of course, one can think, or at least one can think more immediately of Swift and Gulliver's Travels, for instance. You know, the absurdity of a situation where some people are 6 inches tall.
Yeah.
And at another time, there you also encounter other people who are, say, 60 feet tall, and so on. So the person who was a giant vis-a-vis people who are 6 inches tall becomes, you know, a midget vis-a-vis people who are 60 feet tall, you know, and so on, you know. One can think of Cervantes, you know, Don Quixote, for instance, you know, or more appropriately, Rabelais. You know, the French, you know, writer with those fantastic, you know, creations, you know, he has. So, in a way, there are, you know, sort of great comic, you know, creations, you know, in world literature.
Well, I was also thinking that Marching to Heaven might also be similar to some degrees to Swift's A Modest Proposal, because it's just as absurd.
Oh, yes, you know, again, he was, so incredible in that, you know, great, you know, modest, you know, proposal, you know, in terms of sheer comedy, sheer comic genius, you know, obviously, Gulliver's Travels, you know, is absolutely, you know, outstanding.
Now, I actually wanted to ask, I know that you have also been a playwright as well as a novelist, and there are sections of this book that are comprised almost entirely of dialogue, and in fact, sometimes nothing but dialogue. I was wondering, under what circumstances do you feel that dialogue can drive the narrative in fiction, as opposed to sorts of description or action or gesture and that kind of thing?
Actually, it's very challenging, but very interesting how dialogue actually can carry, you know, the narrative. Remember that the African folkloric tradition, what we call orature, there's no strict demarcation of forms, you know, in a narrative. You know, fiction, a narrative can change quite quickly into performance, you know, and performance can easily change into a narrative, you know, and so on, you know, and I try to feel free to utilize all those possibilities within the folkloric, you know, tradition.
Yeah.
So performativity or performance is quite important and central, actually, in Wizard, you know, of the Crow, where apart from the dialogue, people are in constant performances, you know, of themselves, even. And there's a way in which, as you can see, even the character of Wizard the Crow is itself, you know, a performance.
Oh, absolutely, and I was going to remark upon that theatrical manner in which they managed to dupe it. It's the mirror, for example, is a very key manner with the way in which Kamiti and Yowera managed to dupe the Abrurians. Now, I'm wondering if this your experience in theater had much to do with sustaining this illusion. Did your experience in theater kind of have you thinking in terms of theater in how these characters were, you know, duping
the... It's actually very interesting that in the novel, for instance, of course, in Wizard of the Crow, Yaoir herself has been a student of both history and theater.
Yeah.
You know, so she, in her own educational career, she has been a performer. So in the creation of the characters, theater is central, is theater is also at the you know, at the center, you know, and therefore what we see later in the novel is in fact almost theatricality upon theatricality.
Well, you have also the ruler's aides have very much kind of theatrical appendages in the sense that they have large noses, large ears, and that sort of thing. Was theater just pretty much kind of predominantly this driving force in terms of examining how these issues related to this really crazy land of Abruria?
Abruria, actually. Okay. Yes, again, you know, I mean, yeah, I'm glad you mentioned these psychophants, you know, who have to enlarge half of their body to ensure that the half of their body, in a way, themselves perform the role they intend or they want to play in their services to the ruler. You know, for instance, you know, Macho Kali, the one who goes to London.
Yeah.
Have his eyes enlarged surgically, you know, larger than those of a bar, you know, the electric bulb. But then he loves, because he wants his eyes to see, to roam around the world.
Yeah.
In his service, or in his service for the interests of, in servicing the interests of the ruler, wherever and whenever, whatever those lay in the world, you know. So in that sense, his body becomes almost a theatrical expression of the services he wants to render the dictator. The same for Siki Oku, who goes to Paris to have his ears enlarged. So they become larger than those of a rabbit.
Yeah.
And it's because he wants to play the role of spying for the ruler so that he can hear the enemies of the ruler wherever in the world they may be hidden, or wherever in the homes of Afrarians they may be hidden.
It's interesting, too, that they have to go to Europe to actually get these surgical transplants actually affected. And this also brings up the concept of white ache, in which you have characters, including Taji Rika, longing for this sort of European sort of existence. And I was wondering why these sorts of extraordinary afflictions attached to Europe, as opposed to sort of showing the horror of European intervention in Africa just through action. Why these sorts of larger-than-life things?
The impact, really, of Europe and Imperial West, generally, yeah, on the Third World. Remember that the impact of Imperial West on the Third World is not only at the level of economics and politics and so on, but it's also at the level of culture and psychology.
Mm.
You know, so that you can see how these characters, you know, Wizard of the Crow, even when they are deforming themselves,
yeah,
you know, they deform themselves in terms of Europe. You know, so Macho Kali goes to London because obviously he identifies with say the English, you know. And his rival goes to Paris because he identifies with France. But you can also see in those acts that both characters are enacting the historical rivalries between France and England. Yeah. in their own actions, they are also enacting the history of Europe, which in a way becomes their own history, and they identify with that history.
I also wanted to remark upon the extraordinary affliction that a few characters suffer, where they can only say if only, and they can't, or just, they can't even speak. And it's almost, does this sort of stem from the kind of events that you're attempting to portray in this book, in the sense
because
that...
They themselves, you know, they have come to identify, they've come to internalize, if you like, European or colonial racism, if you like, they have internalized it. So there's a way in which they look at themselves very much in terms of the colonial racism. And also what we are seeing also in the novel is an Africa and a third world, you know, made really in the image of the, of the West.
Gotcha. I wanted to remark also on the character of Taji Rika. He was a very extraordinary character for a number of reasons. While he commits these many terrible actions, such as beating his wife, and he treats committee like dirt when he asks for a job, but at the same time, you really rake this character across the coals. I mean, he's almost like this punching bag. You put him through some really terrible circumstances, and it almost was enough for me to start feeling sorry for the guy. I was wondering if this was a character who really kind of kept you going, that just you wanted to sort of see how crazy you could continue this character's descent into madness.
Well, he's a character, he's one of the characters who literally impose themselves on the novel, so to speak.
Yeah.
And they just would not go away.
Yeah.
In other words, at the in the original conception of the novel, he was going to be really a minor character.
Huh.
But he refused to go away. He kept on being there, and he kept on being there. And at the end, we see the logic of his presence, you know, in the novel.
Yeah.
But it's another way of looking at this. Some of the... What's horrible about some of these dictatorships in Africa,
yeah,
in Latin America, Southeast Asia, is how sometimes the details could be so charming.
Yeah.
The horror sometimes lay in their very charismatic, in their very charisma. You know, you take, for instance, Idi Amin of Uganda.
Yeah.
You know, this big fool whom everybody thought they could fool when he was actually fooling everybody.
Yeah.
Okay. And it seems he enjoyed the fact he could fool people who thought they were fooling him. Only that, in that play of who fools who, of course, you know, was so much blood of the ordinary descendant.
I wanted to remark, actually, this is going to be a pretty lengthy question, a big baggy monster of one, but it does bear in mind your history as a writer. Now, I know that you have written in Gikuyu for since basically you emerged from your imprisonment, and yet the characters in this book speak Kiswahili and often in English. I know you also wrote an essay called On the Abolition of the English Language in 1968, where you observed that historical continuity of a culture can be more effectively observed through this African prism instead of a colonial language. I'm wondering if there is any sort of challenges or things that you lose when you translate your own Gikuyu into English. And I'm also wondering why you decided upon Kiswahili as the Abrurian language. Do you feel that also the colonial language of English does justice to your voice? Or?
Yeah. First of all, by the way, that what we called for in 1969 at Nairobi University was for the abolition of the English department, not English language.
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. English department.
Of course, the English language, of course, is a great language, like many languages in the world. It's a great language.
Yeah, my mistake.
But what we called for was the abolition of the English department. But what we meant by that was the English department as then organized. What we found in Africa at the time when we wrote that call, and which, by the way, ushered the era of post-colonial theories and studies and so on, what we called for was a very absurd the situation in which an English department in Africa had only the history of English literature from Spencer to Spender, you know, or from Shakespeare, say, to T.S. Eliot, you know, this was all central. But at the time, when there was a lot of literature from Africa, from Asia, from Latin America, mm-hmm. from Afro-America, and so on, in it, English literature, in that narrow sense, was at the center of the literary studies in Africa. So what we were really saying was, no, let's change it the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
But we have African literature, Asian literature, Latin American literature, say third world literature, at the center of literary studies, and then other literatures around that. In other words, it was a question of consolidating our base in Africa and then connecting to the world. In other words, to see the world through African eyes. Instead of the other way around, we're looking at the world and Africa itself through European eyes. That was a big, our basic, you know, thesis.
Yeah.
But you can see the logic of that. You know, it's the logic of that position that later led me to writing in Gikuyu as opposed to writing in English language. But once again, you see the absurdity, and I call it an absurdity, where many intellectuals in Africa and Asia and Native America write in English or French or Portuguese, when the people who form the culture from which they come largely speak other languages. So you get a discrepancy between intellectuals and intellectual production on one hand, you know, and the people from whom they come on the other. And is this which I'm trying to overcome
mm-hmm.
through my advocacy mm-hmm. of, you know, in the case of Africa, intellectuals writing in African languages.
Gotcha. I'm wondering, though, in terms of your fiction, since you translate your own work from Kikuyu to English, what challenges did you have in maintaining this kind of comic tone? Did you have to sacrifice certain narrative elements? Were there specific meanings?
Oh, yeah. That's a good. First of all, let me say that, of course, rendering the musicality of one... All languages have their own musicality, their mm-hmm. own sort of, you know, their own peculiarities and so on, the way they view the world, the way they express that world, you know. But it's very difficult, actually, to render the musicality of one language in terms, you know, of another, particularly when the structures of two languages, you know, are very different. For instance, Igbo language is very tonal, not as tonal as Yoruba, but tonal also, where one word, depending on how it is sounded or pronounced, can actually have different meanings. English is not so tonal, except for a few words here and there. So what difficult in Wizard of the Crow, some of the actions depend on misinterpretation
mm-hmm.
of a word, the meaning of a word, depending on the tone the hearer has responded to. Now, in rendering that kind of thing into English, I do sometimes write extra words or extra lines to contextualize the reaction of a given character to a statement by another character. So that was the real challenge. The other thing which was important for me in writing, at least Wizard of the Crow, was the playfulness of language. In many African languages, there's a lot of bantering, you know, especially when people are talking to each other, mm-hmm. you know, serious matters. Kind of playfulness of language, very, very important. And it was a challenge to me in trying to create that kind of playfulness in English. Mm. I'm just hoping that I managed to carry over some of that playfulness into yeah. English, at least when I'm reading to crowds of people here in America or in Britain.
Yeah.
At least I do hear them laughing.
Yeah.
So I get the impression that I did manage to render some of the playfulness, at least a hint of it, in English. Yeah.
I'm wondering also, to go back to my initial Big Baggy Monster question about the Abrurians speaking in Ikuyu instead of they're having them speak in Kiswahili?
Oh yes, that as well. Now again, that's a very important question. You see, in Africa, particularly in Kenya, where I come from,
mm-hmm.
We have literally a three language situation.
Okay.
Yeah. English is the official, is official language of administration, of education, of politics, of the marketplace, so of international relations, etc., etc. You know, but every community in Kenya will also have their own language, you know, so what do I call them, ethnic languages, if you want.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there is a lingua franca. In our case, that lingua franca is Kiswahili, which is spoken across the many nationalities that make up, say, Kenya or Tanzania or Uganda, say, East Africa in general. Yeah. Now, that I found in writing Wizard of the Crow, I found it very, very useful, I found it a challenge and also very useful to exploit that complex linguistic situation in Africa. That's why some of the characters speak some words in Kiswahili,
mm-hmm.
Some words in English, you know, and it's also possible, if I knew more African languages, it's also possible to find some characters who speak other African languages, you know, as well.
So this was a way for you to kind of explore again the clash between Africa and Europe through the languages.
I didn't get that. Can you say that again?
I'm sorry about that. So, this kind of language clash was also a way for you to explore the clash between Europe and Africa.
Yeah, especially, you know, the class differentiation. You can also use, I mean, for instance, characters who are formally educated. You know, but that, you know, we've, you know, gone to secondary schools, to university, and so on, are more likely to be speaking or using more English words than characters who are from the working class or from the small farming groups, and so on, you know. Those who count small farmers, workers, and generally urban dwellers are more likely to be speaking both their own language as well as the national lingua franca, which is Kiswahili in this case, you know. So the language situation can also help us, at least me, the writer, to explore the different, you know, classes, you know, in Africa, and their different relationships to Europe, or their different levels of unification with the West.
Gotcha. I wanted to ask you about your imprisonment. You secretly wrote this entire book, The Devil on the Cross, on toilet paper. Now, these are, for me, I'm sure for most people, extraordinary circumstances in which to write a book. And I'm wondering if writing is easier for you because you have this compunction, because I know you are a pretty prolific guy, but at the same time, I'm just wondering if there's still difficulty for you, given that you had this a remarkable drive to carry on in really extraordinary conditions.
Yeah, for me, writing is an act of resistance for me. You know, I have to write to survive.
Yeah.
And when I was imprisoned at a maximum security prison in Kenya in 1978, the whole of 78, and I was imprisoned because of writing in an African language as opposed to writing in English. And so, although, of course, the authorities also did not like what was contained in what I wrote in those languages. But still, I've lost the point, you know, but I'll come back to it. Okay. Remind me the point.
Well, the point is that basically these are really extraordinary circumstances to write a book.
Oh, yes. I was going to say that for me, you know, being imprisoned in a maximum security prison, you know, writing became an act of resistance. You know, I was imprisoned in a maximum security prison because of writing in an African language, and I was determined to continue doing that in under prison conditions. You know, that in a way, that very act of writing in a local language in a maximum security prison under those very adverse conditions, you know, became, you know, not only a means of resistance, but a means of my own spiritual survival. Very, very important.
So it's so integral.
It's the same thing also, yeah, when I was forced into exile in 1982.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for a number of years after being forced into exile, I lived in London in an English language environment. And then in America, in an English language environment. And the question for me, under those circumstances, was I going to be faithful to my commitment to continue writing in an African language or not? But I used the very difficulties of being in exile, the very fact of being distanced from where my own language was being used, I used that as a challenge to my imagination. So, putting briefly, for me, writing under those kind of circumstances, you know, is an act of resistance, and for me, been very, very important for my own spiritual and intellectual survival. But I've got another advantage in a way, you know, because I believe my philosophical outlook, I believe not in isolation of phenomena or isolation of places and things and so on, but I believe in their connection, you know. So that when I was in prison, I was going to say, what connects this prison to the rest of the population, you know? And in so doing, I began to see there were a lot, there's a way in which prison itself, you know, is a reflection of the larger society, and many of the contradictions in the larger society are also reflected in the prison conditions. There's a way in which you can learn a lot about the larger society by looking at conditions, you know, in prison as well. When you're in exile, you know, America, for instance, is connected to Africa, to Asia, and so on. The same thing with Europe, and so on. Because what's happening in America or Europe is affecting what's happening in the remotest part of Africa and Asia.
Yeah.
You know, so again, when one is in Europe, one also must try to see what are the connections of power, relations, say, between Africa, between where one is living and where one comes from, in my case, living in Europe and America, and having come from Kenya and Africa.
So in asserting your identity through writing, it's also a matter of just really kind of asserting or trying to discover these associations that you see, whether through many-fold social issues in Wizard of the Crow, or whether through international relations?
Yeah, that's, in a way, that's a way in which Wizard of the Crow is, in a way, that in a sense, very, very personal. It's a sort of survival, but in trying to see those connections, the novel itself helped me to see many connections. For instance, the landscape of the novel, as you can see, goes beyond Africa. There are some sections of the novel which are set in India, Chennai. I bring Eastern philosophies and religions into contact with or in conversation with African world views and so on. There are some sections of the novel which are set in New York, for instance, some of the more dramatic, absurd happenings take place actually in New York, when the ruler has come to address the United Nations, General Assembly. So, wherever I am, I try and see those connections, and in so doing, it helps me clarify my own place, if you like, in the or the world, or that it helps me understand, for the better, for me anyway, how the world is moving.
Gotcha. One last question. I wanted to actually ask you about the cues in this book. What was the inspiration for these?
Again, as you can see, the queue can become a symbol of our time.
Yes.
And if you are queuing for food, queuing for jobs, queuing for scarce resources, and so on, that's why in the novel, in Wizard of the Crow, the queue becomes almost, a metaphor, whether it's a queue or not a queue. Whether queues should be legalized,
yeah,
and become a national state ideology, or whether they should be banned, become the site of revolutionaries and so on, all those things are important, in the narrative. But there's a way in which the queue is a phenomenon of our world today. The queue for food, the queue for jobs.
Well, it's almost as if the thing that really is pretty hilarious about the queues in the book is that, okay, this forms for a very specific purpose, for jobs. And instead of actually going to, ask people about this queue who are standing in line, they essentially create the queue investigation committee. And it's almost as, again, this really interesting absurdity where they're not really willing to dwell or actually ask the people who are standing in line. It's this kind of, I guess, for you, I wanted to ask if absurdity kind of comes from associating these or observing these disconnects that people have between classes, between nations.
Yeah, the connection. I keep on coming to the word connection.
Yeah.
You only connect, to use Foster's phrase, you only connect. Again, the cue, what could argue in the novel anyway, actually as an image, as you come to think of it. You remember throughout the novel, in fact, the queuing has become a system in the world.
Yeah.
And the four or five emissaries who had been sent initially to spread the gospel of queuing,
yeah,
to the four corners of the country,
yeah,
they go beyond and they go to all over the world preaching the gospel of queuing.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the queues change in terms of people organizing themselves and calling for a new world of hope. The people saying from all corners of the world, let them not kill hope.
Yeah.
Let them not kill our future. You know? So, and this comes from cues seen as sites of, like, organization.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, Googie, it was a great pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Love that girl.